Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and welcome to The Miracle Within You, the show at the intersection of psychology, medicine, and spirituality that considers how the mind and body interact with each other to influence health and healing. With years of experience as a practicing psychologist in the health and wellness fields, and as a writer covering amazing stories of healing, I will explore with my guests how numerous factors influence our lives and our health. Thank you for listening. Hi, and welcome to this edition of The Miracle Within You. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin, and today I'm delighted to have with me Dr. Jay Wiles, who is an HRV, nervous system regulation specialist, who has worked with many, many athletes and others to help create coherence and control within the nervous system, which is so important. We're going to be talking about that today with Jay. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jay.
Yeah, excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's great. He's actually just up the road from me, well, sort of, in Greenville, South Carolina. We'll get to know a little bit more as we go on. But first and only question, tell us a little bit about your career trajectory and how you got to be what you're doing today.
Sure. The interesting thing about my journey, I think that's kind of different than a lot of people who I speak with, is I kind of knew what I wanted to do at a very young age. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because I'm a psychologist by trade, but I didn't have parents who were in psychology. I had a mom who was in healthcare as a nurse. And then my dad was in business. So he was kind of a high performing executive. So I think that is one of the things that kind of pushed me more towards working with high performers. And I can speak a little bit about that here in a bit. But I actually just always had, and I know it sounds a bit cliche, this deep rooted desire to kind of understand like why people behaved and acted the way that they acted. And then when those things were quite dysregulated from what we would call normal behavior, how do we get people back on track? And I just had this deep rooted fascination from an early age. And so I remember I was in high school and I didn't necessarily know what like a therapist or a psychologist was like in its entirety, but I knew enough to say, hey, I think psychology is the route to go. And so from freshman year, when I went into school, majored in psychology, got a bachelor's degree in psychology, and then I went on to go get a master's in therapy and clinical counseling. And then after that, I went on and got my doctoral degree in clinical psychology and then licensed as a psychologist. But it was all throughout kind of like this time that I had this evolution from, hey, I want to help people, so very kind of broad, to I think I can help people from an emotional capacity perspective, to I actually think I can help people to optimize, or at least I think that there's a path there. And it wasn't really until I would say I was kind of maybe second or third year into my doctoral program that I started to make much more of a connection between mental and emotional well-being and physiological health and physiological well-being. And I said, okay, like there's obviously this direct connection between emotional well-being and then how it manifests in our body. And then also how we feel physiologically affects our emotional and our mental well-being. So kind of putting those two pieces together was fascinating to me. And kind of my personality is that when I become interested in something, like I kind of go all in. It's kind of like those individuals who like once they get that hobby that they really enjoy, like they, it's like, I mean, I'm a golfer. So it's like golfer is kind of like a gear-headed type of sport. So it's like you got to buy one thing and then the next. And then, hey, the next year comes around, all in on the next thing and researching and watching YouTube videos. Well, I do the same thing, but with my own kind of like academic and personal interests. And so I became really fascinated with this whole idea of like, well, if we start to work on things within the aspect of our physiology and we train our physiology, can that affect like the way we feel emotionally and interact from a cognitive perspective? And so that brought me to like when, and I really didn't encounter this until I got into like my first year of residency, I started to see that there are actually ways that we can not only train our physiology, but we can measure the outcomes. We can actually measure how our nervous system and our physiology responds through data. And I was exposed to this actually in a pain clinic. So in residency, you do different rotations. And one of the rotations that I did was, and I was at the Department of Veteran Affairs at this time, is was in a pain clinic. And this pain clinic was really interesting because the intention here was to titrate individuals off of opiate-based medications. Because obviously we know there's a lot of downstream negative effects of those, and then integrate things like integrative or functional therapies as a way to help with pain management. And so this was a clinic that used things like acupuncture and nutrition and Tai Chi and mindfulness meditation and guided imagery, and there was a bunch of other ones. But the other one that I was really fascinated with was this thing called biofeedback, and I never really heard of biofeedback. But I sat in on a session who there was a specialist there who did this. And I watched what was going on, and I was fascinated because I was like, so you're telling me that we can take information from the body and we can quantify that and we can show that almost as like a reflective mirror to the individual and help that individual to train resiliency, essentially, basically, like by looking at how their nervous system is responding to these interventions. And so, again, kind of that, the rest is kind of history there. I was hooked. And so that was close to a decade, actually, it was over a decade ago, which is hard to believe. And ever since then, like that has been kind of the field of study. So it's been psychophysiology and heart rate variability and biofeedback. And so from then, it's been just kind of a hard charging route of like I started with the VA, went on and opened up my own consulting clinic, started a technology company back in 2021, exited that company in 2023, started another one at the end of 2023, and kind of here we are today in 2026. So it's been a long kind of journey, but everything kind of started with a centralized focus. Now, this whole idea of like I'm really fascinated with just like what can we do to learn more about human behavior and improve people's sense of emotional and mental well-being in maybe different and unique, and I would even argue more sticky ways.
Yes. Thank you so much. That's great. And that's great also that you knew pretty early on what you wanted to do. And you weren't forced into that. That
That's
just came
right.
from you, you know. And you know, I had a similar trajectory. You know, my parents actually had virtually no educations. They didn't know anything about science or anything. And the only two careers they knew about were was law and accountancy, because in my dad's business, he was a bookmaker, bookie. You know, he needed both of those. And just by pure chance, a teacher at my school was doing a psychology class. And he talked to me, and I got to speak to this professor, and I found my direction. So that's great that you were able to do that. Now let's get to a very critical point here. I believe that what you're doing is very important and underrated in terms of how medicine treats people. And you know, the miracle within you comes from the fact that I ran into a variety of people, most of whom have been on guests on the show, who seem to have defied medical prognosis, told they only had a couple months to live and survived and still living today. And the one thing that I saw they had in common was a mindset and a resilience that did not allow them to get pulled into the negativity of the diagnosis. They, you know, they kept optimistic, let's put it that way. And I think that is really important. I think that coherence of the nervous system, the regulation of the nervous system, what you are doing, we know that if the nervous system is dysregulated, your physiology gets screwed up. Your immune system doesn't work as well,
100%.
etc., etc. And so I really believe that this regulation of the nervous system, which sounds like, oh, it should be fairly easy to do and what have you, is a very important part of recovery and healing.
Yeah, I would argue 100% in favor of what you just said. The interesting thing about working and spending a career and working with high performers, and I've spoken about this a lot to high performers themselves, but also on different shows, is that a defining feature, especially from a mindset perspective, is this like sense of grandiosity that no matter what, they're going to make it through it and figure out a way. When odds are st like when odds are against them, that's actually typically when high performers thrive. And what I see from them is a nervous system that is responds very differently than people who don't have kind of like that centralized mindset. It is one that says, hey, all systems go, let's do this. Let's manage and self-regulate and find a way. Like there is no other option other than just finding a way. And when you contrast that with other individuals, maybe who have pretty significantly dysregulated nervous systems and also come in with a mindset that isn't maybe high priority of resilience, is that they kind of approach things more from a woe is me. I don't know if I can actually make it through this thing. And then what happens? All these downstream negative effects. Their nervous system crumbles. We see it. They have a hard time self-regulating. And of course, what is that? How does that manifest? Anxiety, depression, stress, and so forth. And so for me, I'm always interested when I work with these individuals, whether it's a pro athlete or a high-performing executive, I'm just always interested to kind of hear how they mentally or cognitively approach problems. And then also to watch what happens to their nervous system under stress. Like there's a clear distinctive profile, and we've done this, and this has been seen in numerous studies, but I've also seen this in clinic as well, is if you put a high performer under a stressful situation and you monitor and measure how their nervous system responds, they're going to have a stress response. It's not like they don't have a stress response. We're human, right? Like we need to gear up and to have this level of self-preservation and protection. So you see things like heart rate increase, blood pressure increase. They're not like immortal, but what I do love seeing is that when you give them the opportunity to recover, even if you don't prompt them to recover in that time period, what happens? Well, when the stressor is removed, or even if the stressor is not removed, they find a way to self-regulate. They've kind of keyed that nervous system in to be reflexive, to be able to handle what's in front of them. Now, again, that's contrasted with someone who maybe, and again, not necessarily not a high performer, but maybe someone who doesn't have, hasn't built up the capacity and resiliency yet to handle things like that. When you put them into a stressful situation, psychophysiologically, all these metrics increase, but then when you give them the opportunity and pull that away, it remains. And this is kind of the problem of that chronic sustained experience of stress when we don't have the tools and interventions to manage it, is that these things persist and they have a lot of negative downstream effects, both physiologically, but then also mentally as well.
Absolutely. And of course, that's a problem with the culture and the society today is we have this brain that's really geared, prioritized for survival, but it gets activated by things that aren't really threats to us.
That's
And
right.
so people live in fear, they're manipulated by their fear, and it just gets worse and worse. Certainly your nervous system needs to tell you you're in trouble, if you're on Normandy Beach on D-Day and you're being shot at and your buddies are being killed. But if they don't have the bananas you want in the store, there's no need to go there. But unfortunately, that's what we do. And it's almost like we need a brain 2.0 where the emotional system is calmed down to the point where it goes into gear when you really need it, not all these other times where you don't really need it.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
it's a
Well, because
problem.
it's a big problem. I think that the thing that happens a lot of the times in modern day culture is that we demonize this word stress. We see stress as like this solely negative thing. And I argue actually the exact opposite. I think that stress is inherently good because stress is nothing but a signal. It's a warning sign. And so I don't want people to think, oh man, my whole life should be structured around minimizing or reducing or eliminating stress. Number one, not realistic. No, not possible. Try to live a life without stress. It's not going to happen.
Boring.
However, exactly, it'd be quite boring. However, it's being able to tune the nervous system to understand both when this is a viable threat, something that you need your stress response to be turned on and to stay on for, for that matter, or when it's just something something that's acute. And most of the time, and I know this is a bit cliche, but most of the time, the stress that we experience is very acute. It's very transient. It's very here and now. Or even worse, and this is what happens with so many people, it's very future oriented. We're just concocting some worst case scenario of how we think things are going to ultimately play out for us. And so the nervous system, it doesn't realize that the thing's not actually happening. It says, well, you're telling me, and you keep feeding and perseverating on this idea that there is a viable threat that's either here or it's coming. Like, that train is coming. And so that kind of almost like perpetual lie that we tell ourselves has the nervous system kick into that fight or flight mode, and then just perpetually stays there. And then inevitably, you know, what ends up happening is that either the event will take place and it's not nearly as damaging as what we predicted, and so therefore we just had all of that perseveration and anxiety and stress and kind of the kicking in of the nervous system for no good reason. Or the other thing that happens is like the event doesn't even happen. Like, nothing even unfolds. And now the way I kind of see it, and I talk to a lot of my high performers, is that you've wasted a lot of time and energy. Like, you've put forth a lot of mental and physical power to address something that, like, you could have allocated those resources elsewhere and actually gotten a lot more return on your investment for that. And so it's just worth noting, because I think so often, like, that is the perpetual cycle people get in. And it's just so incredibly damaging, not even just to them, but to the people around them in their inner circle, because they feel it, they experience it, whether it's their coworkers, their family, their friends, their kids. It's really a rough one.
Yes, well said. We're going to take a short break from our great commercial sponsors. Then we'll be back and talking about the techniques that you use and have developed to help regulate this major problem. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Miracle Within You. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Jay Wiles. And in that first section, we really talked about something important, your nervous system, and how it can be ramped up to ridiculous levels, which has major implications on everything in your life, including your health. So, Jay, we talked about the importance of being able to manage the nervous system and create that coherence. So the next big question is, well, how do you do that? And you're the expert in that.
You know, the default that a lot of people end up having is they think, okay, so if I'm experiencing, let's say, an emotional difficulty, stress, anxiety, depression, or even a mental health concern, that the default should be, okay, well, now I need to go to therapy. And I want to be very clear here, because, again, just to be transparent, I'm a psychologist by trade. So I definitely think that there is a time and a place for mental health therapy, talk therapy, psychotherapy. I think, though, that what ends up ultimately happening and why so many people drop out, and again, this is kind of more of my own personal experience and opinion, than it is something that I would say is necessarily truly validated, is I think that so many people are going into therapy and they just don't have the physiological, or I would say psychophysiological, capacity to get into a lot of the deeply rooted stuff that they're experiencing. So if you think about someone who's got deeply rooted relational issues or even trauma or something that is indeed a problem that they need to address, going straight into it, it's like, well, now I'm opening up this can of worms to talk about all these things on top of a base that is your nervous system that isn't ready to handle it. And so I've heard a lot of people talk about this whole phrase of, you know, when you try to address problems of the mind with the mind, you end up kind of like at this impasse. It's just really difficult. And it's why people, and like I talk about a lot of high performers, will say, well, you know, I realize that I have a high degree of stress, and I try to do this meditation stuff, right? This mindfulness practice. And it's so incredibly difficult for me. Like, I can't sustain a practice. Well, mindfulness meditation is great, but it's also a very cognitive heady practice and can be quite difficult. So then you say, okay, well, Jay, if that's the case and we're not going to jump maybe necessarily just straight to therapy, or should we add something in with therapy, what would it be? And that's where I argue, and kind of part of my model, which is really looking at nervous system resiliency training, or what I call NSRT, is this whole idea of using the bottom, what I call the bottom-up axis. And the bottom-up axis is saying, well, we need to generate and build the psychophysiological capacity, the nervous system capacity, to be able to do the depth work of things like therapy, or even integrate mental attunement training and mindfulness and meditation. It's not to say that we should choose one or the other. We can do them in tandem. But I say that most people in general that I work with, they benefit most when they start from the bottom up. So what is bottom up? It means that we need to be able to regulate our physiology. And this actually isn't something, Howard, that's like immensely complex. It's complex in terms of our physiology is complex, but the lever that we pull is actually not that difficult to pull. Anyone could do it. And so for people listening right now, I can kind of propose a tier system of like, hey, this is accessible right now, to like, hey, here's some more advanced ways. But the biggest thing that you can do is use your breathing. I think that so often that people don't realize that the strongest and most direct lever that they can utilize in order to manage their nervous system response is breathing. And there's kind of two ways to look at this. There is more of what happens in regards to, or what can we leverage to engage in what we call state change, which means in the moment, transient, acute, anxiety's high, I'm stressed, I need help now, not later, now. Breathing is a great way to change your state. What does that look like? Slowing it down. Like, that is like the most simple way to put it. So often we breathe at a very rapid rate, and especially when we're under high degrees of stress. When we're under high degrees of stress, we can increase the breathing or respiratory rate anywhere from 25-50%, sometimes even 100%. We call that a panic attack, typically. We're hyperventilating. Mm-hmm. A 25-50% increase in respiration, or how fast you're breathing, that's a lot. And the nervous system, how does it take that? It says threat. Like, well, when you need to run and get away from something or fight something, like, you need to be taking in oxygen. And so therefore you're going to increase how rapid you're breathing. So one of the biggest things is just slow it down. So when I say slow it down, just do about 6 breaths per minute. And the easy way to calculate that is a 5-second inhale and a 5-second exhale, or a 4-second inhale, 6 seconds exhale. You don't need any type of technology. You don't need anything other than to be able to count up to 5 and out to 5. And what do we know happens there? Something actually pretty significant changes. When you slow your breathing down, you do a couple of things. The first thing that you do is that you actually engage one of the strongest nerves in your entire body, called the wandering nerve or the vagus nerve. It's your 10th cranial nerve. What is that nerve intended to do? It's a parasympathetic branch of nerves. And parasympathetic just means more of like the intention to rest, digest, slow things down. Because when we're in a state of stress, things are moving kind of rapidly. Tunnel vision, can't think straight. so forth. So this helps to slow things down. So when you slow your breathing down, you actually stimulate in real time that nerve, that vagus nerve. And so I like to think of it like as we call it the vagal break. It is a great way to just slow and speed the heart rate up and down. And that's actually via your own exertion. You're controlling it. And that's kind of a key point for people to take here is when you engage in slow paced breathing, you're actually the one who's removing and pressing that break yourself. And so again, that can happen in a very acute, transient way to slow things down. The other thing that I would mention is that the more consistent you do that, even outside of, let's say, stressful conditions, the more consistent that you do that and the more time you put into it, the more your nervous system actually starts to make adaptations. What do I mean by that? When your nervous system starts to adapt, then it starts to become more reflexive to these stressful situations. So maybe you don't have to think as consciously about slowing the nervous system down. It automatically engages because you've been training it in that direction. So for a lot of people, the best intervention that I can give them is just say, every day I want you to go to the nervous system gym. The nervous system gym is just spending like 8 to 12 minutes. We'll split the difference and say 10 minutes. Of just slow paced breathing. Again, there's more advanced technologically savvy ways that we can get into here in a second, but if you don't have the finances and all you have is the time to do this, then it's just a matter of, hey, set a timer on your phone for 8 minutes or 10 minutes. And for that period of time, count and breathe into five, exhale to five, and just keep doing that over and over. You will train your nervous system to adapt. And not only will you feel better now, you will also feel better over time. So that's like the biggest lever that I can tell people to pull. And the thing is that I'm not stating something here that number one is very difficult, but number two is not something that actually requires us to spend an inordinate amount of time or even money on. You can spend some money doing stuff like this and quantifying it, but this is just something that's free and accessible to anybody. Now, there's other mechanisms that we can chat about in regards to levers that we can pull, but I would say that in the immediate, there is nothing that is as potent as breathing.
I agree 100% with that, and that's been my tool, go-to tool in a stressful situation. Just breathe, just breathe, calm it down, and it works. It works, and it's as you rightly say, anyone can do it. It's simple, it doesn't cost anything, and you make a really good point about therapy there. Look. Change is about doing things. It's not about talking about them. Now, there's value in talking and trying to understand, but then it gets you to, okay, what am I going to do about this? And your nervous system underpins everything. So if you want to change, you got to control that. Otherwise, you'll be spending forever going in and out of the stress state, which is not what you want to do. So yeah, I'm on board with you that too. So tell us a little bit more about perhaps some of the, so there's the basic, anyone can do it, and then I presume there are some more sophisticated technological things.
Yeah, the one thing that can be a little bit difficult in setting more of, let's say, the behavioral skill of breathing is that when you think about counting into five and then exhaling to five, is that you do that enough times and it can feel a bit monotonous. And what we know about behavior, and I know that you know this very well, is that if you create a routine that is nothing but monotonous, there's no novelty to it, we're not kind of changing things up, you're not getting information and feedback, it becomes very difficult to sustain that behavior. And so for me, as a psychologist, I'm all about like, well, I need to figure out how to help people sustain behavior. It's like what I mentioned earlier. It's like, how do we understand why things affect people and then how to get them to kind of do things? Because we know that behavior change is just really difficult. Think about how much money is made kind of today's day and age on different diets or different exercise routines. It's like everybody thinks, oh, if I just change it up, then that's the thing that's going to be helpful. And maybe that can be helpful, but only for a short period of time. We have to make that behavior sticky and we have to tie it to a value system. So for me, if we kind of take breathing to the most or to the next most advanced level, it's, well, can we give information on how this breathing is actually affecting you? Because if I know that it's affecting me and I can see and understand that, Okay, now it locks in cognitively and it becomes more sticky. It becomes real.
Right.
It's like meditation, right? Like we know from the literature that meditation is an immensely helpful strategy for both nervous system regulation, but also just general mental and emotional well-being. Meditation is an absolutely helpful, validated method. However, most people that I ask about meditation, they're like, well, I think it's working, but I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I'm feeling better, but I'm also a little bit irritated because my mind just keeps wandering. Mm-hmm. Like you get all this, that kind of feedback. And I totally get it because, you know, it's like, if you were to go to the physician and they were to say, hey, listen, like we checked your blood pressure and it's high. Like you are hypertensive. You have high blood pressure. We need to do it so that they give you some intervention, whether it's whatever, a medication, stress management profile, well, whatever they give you. And they're like, okay, and good luck. But then you never check it again. I was like, how do I know any of this is working? How do I know the medication's working? How do I know the nutrition changes or the exercise or the stress resiliency? You don't know. So what do? You check it over and over and over again. And then it gives you that validation that, yes, this is actually working for me. I say that all to say is that we can do the same thing in regards to checking and monitoring changes that are occurring in your nervous system. And this is one of the great things, right? It's like I talked earlier about therapy and mental health. And we know that these treatments are effective because we've done studies and looked at different validated measures to say, okay, pre and post someone's depression score dropped, or pre and post someone's anxiety score, or you fill in the blank there, PTSD score. Well, we actually have metrics like that for the nervous system. So we can look and see both what's happening in real time to the nervous system, and so acutely, but then also track it longitudinally. So track it over time to see, are we making trait change to the nervous system? Is the nervous system adapting? Like, are we building more of that muscle that is the nervous system? And that's the beauty of it. And this is where my field, which is psychophysiology and biofeedback, come into play. And a certain metric that we use that you alluded to earlier is heart rate variability. So heart rate variability is the single greatest non-invasive proxy that we have for managing the adaptations of the nervous system. In other words, kind of put more simply, like, is your nervous system responding and saying, hey, I can take this on. I'm resilient to be able to handle this. Or is it saying, I need some help. Like I'm suffering. I'm not doing too well. HRV can be that metric. And the interesting thing now is that HRV is a fairly ubiquitous metric. Like if anybody has any wearable, like it's collecting that data. So whether it's an Aura Ring or a Whoop or a Garmin, Fitbit, Apple Watch, it's all collecting that data. So people can track that over time. You know, it's a bit nuanced because some are better than others, but that's probably a topic for a different discussion. The one thing that I think most people would find valuable here is using HRV in real time with paired breathing. That's what we refer to as HRV biofeedback. So what does that look like? It looks like the same thing that I mentioned earlier, which is doing, let's say, paced, slow paced breathing, but in real time, watching how your nervous system responds. How might someone actually see changes in real time? They would see that this slow paced breathing is starting to create these big, what we call sinusoidal waves in their heart. So as you inhale, heart rate will significantly increase. And then as you exhale, you put the vagal brake on and you see your heart rate significantly decrease. And this big swing creates change in time between your successive heartbeats. And that change, heart rate variability, is a sign that the nervous system is making an adaptation. The vagus nerve is firing like it should, and you're starting to create more of this environment or milieu that is intended to help relax the mind and body. And when you start to understand and see that, and you watch HRV increase in real time, that's the kind of clue that you get that, oh, look, this slow-paced breathing is actually changing how my nervous system responds. And I'd say that that's kind of like the second way to do it. And that is done with technology. So that does require that we're measuring heart rate, measuring heart rate variability, and then giving you some stimulus to breathe.
Yeah. And there's no question, seeing is believing.
Yeah.
And this is one of the problems. I probably mentioned this a few times on previous podcasts that I've done, but I did a study in Independence, Missouri, in the elementary school on, you know, troubled kids. I did some neurofeedback. And then I would talk to the parents. And this guy came in and said, and he'd just gone through a nasty, was going through a nasty divorce with his wife. And his wife's saying, oh, you know, Freddie's got ADD. And he was saying, no, he hasn't. He's BS. No, you're talking. He's fine. And then he was talking to me and he was explaining this. He doesn't have ADD. And then I pulled out the brain map. And I said, look at this, look at this. And brain maps are very good at being able to show ADD tendencies and brainwaves. And I was able to show him the map. And he started crying. Mm. And when he got it together, he said, okay, I'll make an appointment. If I didn't have a map to show him, he would never believe me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you absolutely have to do that wherever it is possible.
Mm.
Also sort of gamifies it a little bit. Oh, can I get it lower or higher, what have you? So absolutely, absolutely, we need to do that. Thank you so much for that explanation. Really good. Let's take one more short break from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Miracle Within You. And today I'm delighted to be talking with Dr. Jay Wiles. And he is an expert in something very important that is underestimated, the actual regulation of your nervous system. And Jay, we've been talking about various tools, techniques, why this is so important. So how have you put that together today in what you do? What are the ways you operate and how the listeners can access some of that?
Yeah. The interesting thing about monitoring the nervous system is that, you know, we have accessibility to it through a multitude of ways. And that is something that I couldn't have said, you know, a decade ago, 15 years ago. So I'm very happy and privileged to be a part of, you know, kind of the changing of times to watch technology really be able to help us, because technology, unfortunately, has caused a lot of suffering as well. It's kind of like damaged a lot of nervous systems, especially when we think about mindlessly scrolling and watching videos and kind of doing all these other things that we know aren't great for managing the nervous system. It's good to be able to leverage technology that actually is helpful. So when I'm working with people, there are a couple of things that I'm really tuning into. Of course, and again, this comes from my background, both in sports and performance psychology, but also, again, like I throw my clinical psychologist hat a lot. And so for people who aren't familiar with the terms, clinical psychology is much more looking at things like clinical mental health disorders. So say someone with clinical anxiety or depression or trauma and so forth. And then the performance sports psychology is kind of as it stated. It's for enhancing optimal performance kind of within whatever domain they're in, whether it's sports or it's high performance in terms of work or vocation. And so for me, I kind of like to blend the two. I can't help but to blend the two. And so I'm always looking to see for them, like, are there impediments to their ability to perform that are more emotionally unmanaged, whether it is clinical stress, anxiety, and depression? So for me, I'm assessing kind of those things initially, and then we're taking a deep look at their nervous system and their nervous system response, especially over time. The one thing that I never want to make a quick judgment of is how their nervous system responds just based off of one data set, right? It's like this whole idea of, you know, you go and you get blood work periodically, and sometimes things are elevated in your blood work, and it's like, okay, let's keep an eye on that. You know, they could, like, a physician could be like, well, elevated cholesterol, let's throw you on a statin immediately. Like, you could do that. Many physicians unfortunately do that. But some say, okay, well, let's make some lifestyle modifications and, you know, build in some of these protocols, and then we'll check, you know, 6 months down the road. If it's still elevated, then we may need to elevate ourselves to using maybe a more aggressive intervention, but let's start conservative. Same thing with me. I'm always saying I'm not going to make a singular judgment based off of one data reading. I really want to watch how things transpire over time, especially as we start to kind of pull on those different levers. And so I've spoken a lot today about self-regulation through breathing and then the use of biofeedback. So gaining feedback of your nervous system in real time. The other thing that I want to mention, and I would be remiss not to say here, is that we cannot have a conversation about nervous system resiliency and regulation without talking about what I see as the substrate of all nervous system health, which is sleep. Sleep is probably one of the most underrated and undervalued health behaviors that someone can engage in that I would argue holds the most weight for their nervous system. Because again, it's not to say that if you have poor sleep, that things like HRV biofeedback or slow paced breathing can't be helpful. But I think that you are shortchanging yourself if you're not focusing on sleep. And this, however, for me is a big problem because I work with a lot of high performers, and high performers say, I need to maximize every bit of my time. And so therefore the biggest thing that I'll sacrifice is sleep. We see this like all around in the world of high performance. And I see it a lot actually in athletics, which is crazy to me, because you would think, athletes, come on, you know the necessity for recovery and repair that sleep holds. But many of them say, well, if I'm going to cut some corners, like that's the corner I can cut because then I can build other things into my day. And can't I offset the effects of poor sleep with other behaviors? And the answer is clearly no. Like the answer is 100% no. Never think that you can outwork and outperform poor sleep. You just can't. So for me, when I'm working with someone, we're going to pay attention to basically like two strongholds, which is nervous system resiliency in terms of like the breathing components, but then sleep as well. And if sleep is not optimized or someone's sleeping kind of subpar below their baseline, like that's going to be where the bulk majority of our focus goes. Now, good news is that if someone is having difficulty with sleep, for me, I'm like, well, actually a way to help out with sleep is that before bed for 10 minutes as a way to downregulate, let's utilize HRV biofeedback. So again, kind of like killing two birds with one stone here. And it's bi-directional, right? Like these things affect one another. You improve your nervous system regulation, that's going to improve sleep. You improve sleep, that's going to improve nervous system regulation. The two go hand in hand with one another. So when I'm working with someone, like sleep is a huge priority. And it's such a thing that like, if you ask, I can't remember the latest studies and research on it, but it's like more than 50% of people, like at least domestically here in the US where I'm at, about more than 50% of people have some form of either mild or moderate sleep problem. And so because of that, Let's start there and then work on also kind of the key mechanisms to regulate the nervous system that's going to improve sleep, and then sleep is going to, and then indeed improve the nervous system. So for me, it doesn't matter if you're a high performing athlete, you're just, you know, regular Joe, or you're, you know, an executive, I'm going to start kind of at those foundational areas and then try to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And one of the things that we see is that as we improve sleep, those nervous system metrics that I mentioned earlier, they improve. As we improve those nervous system metrics, which again isn't my main goal, my goal is to improve self-regulation and resiliency, we see sleep improve. So I just wanted to mention that because for me, I couldn't have a conversation about the nervous system and not bring up sleep as like a high priority and pillar.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, again, 100% agree with you on that. And it is something people do not understand how important and powerful it is. And they will, as you say, if that's the place they can find an extra couple hours, okay, well, I'll just sleep for 5 hours. Not a good idea. So, yes, 100%. And again, these things are easy to do, right? They are easy to do. And so that is really important. And it's interesting. I'm going to guess here. Do you ever get referred people who are dealing with a serious physical condition to help control them? Or you do?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. And the one that I can speak to that ends up coming into my clinic fairly often is chronic pain, which is funny because this is where I learned about HRV biofeedback, was in chronic pain. So I know that chronic pain is a huge issue, especially like when I talk about veteran populations or individuals, you know, former military, is that they've had their body beat to shreds. And so for them, what was the typical kind of MO? It was, hey, here's your medication.
Yep.
And then we found we were over-prescribing those medications. People are addicted to them. It's causing significant downstream negative effects. And so these individuals are like, well, what can I do to manage my pain response? And this is really cool. We published a study back when I was a resident at the VA, where we looked at the use of HRV biofeedback on pain subjectivity. So essentially someone's perception of pain on a pain scale. And what we found is that we were able to significantly reduce pain subjectivity in an 8-week program by the use of consistent biofeedback. And consistent biofeedback was 4 times a week at about 10 minutes a session. So 40 minutes a week in total of slow paced breathing, which is not a heavy lift, right? 10 minutes a day, 4 times a week, you get 3 days off, and that could actually significantly reduce pain. Now, one of the things I want to be very clear of is, this mean that someone who is an 8 out of 10 on a pain scale is going to now automatically be a 0 or a 1? No. But what I will say is that if you take someone who is at a constant 8 out of 10 pain and you take them down to a 5, that is a world of difference. Like that person will do as much as they can and pay as much as they want to get to that level. That's a significant delta from an 8 to 10, or sorry, an 8 to 5. And so for me, like when I get referred these individuals, I always have such a heart for them, because these people are exhausted. Because what does pain do? It affects your sleep. What does pain do? It affects your emotional well-being. And then therefore the downstream effects is that it keeps people out of work. It keeps people from like going out and being social and within relationships. So that's the one that kind of always comes to mind, is that I am referred those individuals and just have a huge heart for them.
Yes. You know, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. One of the people that I know I had on very early in the series, Jeff Frankhart, worked in the military. He's a therapist, and he was with a team that devised a program that was very similar to this. And the mindset, well, they did physical exercises, but the mindset was no complaining. If you complain, you're out.
That sounds again, very much like military.
yeah. And there's some great stories in there, and it's really a great program. Based on something similar. I don't know whether they used HRV specifically, but it was the same thing. And again, you, as you rightly say, you reduce someone's pain from an 8 to a 5. Oh my gosh. And the results that he got they got were just remarkable. Mm. So I could absolutely see that in relation to pain. Now, before we go, I want you to be able to tell people how they can find more about you and your work and connect, all of that stuff. So
Yeah. So again, thank you for letting me plug that. So I tend to try to be as best as I can updating a lot of like my social media. So on Instagram, it's at Dr. J. Wiles. I also have a Substack. So drjwiles.substack.com. So check out that. A lot of my articles are on this whole model of nervous system resiliency training kind of the bottom up axis. So I produce a content there. If anybody's ever interested kind of on the consulting end, whether you're a high performer, athlete, executive, or you just need some help on nervous system regulation, my main website for consulting is my clinic, which is Thrive Wellness and Performance. So it's thrive-wellness.com. And the other thing that I'll mention too, because I know a lot of people will say, well, okay, well, what kind of biofeedback device do you use, or what's kind of interesting there? And there's a lot out there on the consumer side of things, but I built another company called OHM, O-H-M, and you can visit OHM.health, OHM.health. This is actually a biofeedback lamp that lives in your environment and doesn't require you to sit there and watch your phone. It doesn't require you to put on some other type of wearable. It's just a beautiful lamp that on top is a stone that you pick up, and the stone actually will map and read your heart rate variability, and then actually give you a breathing pacer and some biofeedback in the form of light change and sound change. So it just makes biofeedback super simple for the people who are like, I don't want to use my phone. I don't want to watch a pacer on there. I don't want to have another wearable. So OHM.health is another thing I'll plug as well.
Excellent. We'll have those in the show notes too. But thank you. This has been fantastic, Jay. I really appreciate your time and everything you're doing. It's right on the money, right on the mark. And we need more of it. We need more of it integrated into the conventional medicine system, not just for pain, but if you're fighting a tough diagnosis, you need your nervous system as well regulated as possible to give you a chance. And hopefully we'll get to see this more as time goes on. But again, Jay, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being on here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Miracle Within You. Join me next time when I continue to explore the power of the mind-body and how it can be employed to enhance health and